Today is June 29th, 2010. Bishop George McKinney, Oral History, San Diego State University. Bishop McKinney, welcome.
Thank you, Gloria. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm going to ask a series of questions, but feel free to just talk, and I'll get back with something if there's something I want to be outlined or highlighted. First, I'd like to for you to give an introduction of who you are and what you do, and we'll start from there.
I'm George Dallas McKinney, and I am the founding and senior pastor at St. Stephen's Church of God in Christ. And since 1985, I've served as the bishop for that denomination in Southern California, here in San Diego. I'm also a husband and a father. I was married for 47 years to Jean, and she graduated to glory in 2004. And 4 years later, I had the good fortune of marrying Barbara Jo Warren, who's with me here today. And we will be celebrating 2 years of marriage on August the 9th.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Barbara Jo has a son who is a senior at Hampton University. And Gene and my five sons are age range from 40 to 51. And George, the eldest, is the executive pastor at St. Stephen's. The second son, Grant, is a student at the seminary in Atlanta, Georgia. And the third son is the minister of music at the church. Fourth son is a seminarian at the historically black college, Shaw University School of Theology. And Glenn, the youngest son, who is the minister of youth at the church. So between family and church and the community, I tried to make an impact upon improving the quality of life for the people of this area.
Fantastic. Okay, I'm going to go back into history with you. Some basic background information. When and where were you born? And can you tell me a little bit about your parents, family background, and anything about race relations growing up that you remember, childhood memories that stand out? First, were you born in San Diego?
No, I was born in Jonesboro, Arkansas, August 9th, 1932. My mother was Rosie Thompson McKinney, and my father was same name as mine, George Dallas.
Okay.
Mama was a housewife. She was the mother of 14 children, so it kept her pretty busy.
Yes.
Caring for the children. My dad, we called him Papa, was bivocational. He was a preacher who earned money to support his family by being a shoe cobbler and a sharecropper.
Okay. And sharecroppers, what did sharecroppers do?
Sharecroppers involved their families in planting and harvesting the crops for landowners. Mm-hmm. And they simply got paid by getting a share of the productivity.
Okay.
For example, maybe a landlord would say to the sharecropper, you plant this cotton, hoe it, chop it, and then harvest it, and you'll get a percentage.
Okay.
of when the cotton is sold, you will get a percentage of it. It was.
Did they have any of the land? The sharecropper owned the, any
the sharecropper part? Sharecropper did not own anything.
Okay.
And the sharecropper was really just a kind of a glorified extension of slavery.
Okay. So it was like bartering for you to do this. I'm going to give you just a little bit of the product.
Yeah. And usually the landowner was not fair in what he distributed to the sharecroppers, mm-hmm. because the landowner not only paid all the bills, he weighed the cotton, for example, and took it to the gin, mm-hmm. and he sold it. So the sharecropper really didn't know how much he sold it for.
Okay.
And frequently, the landlord would say to the sharecropper at the end of the season, "I'm very sorry, but this year we didn't make any money. You won't get anything."
Oh, wow.
And there was no recourse. There was no examining of the books.
Right.
There was no way of determining. It was just the landlord said, "We didn't make any money." And the cotton fields may have been producing 2 or 3 bales of cotton per acre.
And this was an annual?
And yeah, some sharecroppers would work for 15 or 20 years and were told every year, "I'm sorry, we didn't make anything this year."
That is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It was a form of slavery. And of course, the other hook there was that the landlord knew that he needed the labor. That was before we had the mechanical cotton pickers and pullers. And so they needed the labor. They had another bait that was that since the message would be there has been no profit,
mm-hmm.
you got to eat between now, between the end of the harvest and the next harvest. So the landlord established grocery stores and let you eat out of the grocery store, but he kept
a running tab
of it. And of course, you had to pay that too.
So that was actually a need to have 2 or 3 jobs on the side.
Yes.
If you were doing this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of memory. But that was a way of life before this World War, before the Great Migration of blacks from the South. Following World War One and Two, most black people were involved in agriculture. In agriculture, now there were some blacks who owned land and who did well,
mm-hmm.
but my background was from the very we were very, very poor.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So, now, out of the 14 children, did they all help Papa in the sharecropping?
We all were involved in the sharecropping. We'd start work when we were big enough to pick cotton. I got started when I was probably 7 or 8.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so what, did you attend school?
5 or 6 months a year.
Okay.
We attended school. From the time we began harvesting the crop in August. We would register for school the first day of school. We didn't have to work on the farms that first day. We'd go register.
Okay.
And then they would know that we would not probably see us again until November.
Okay.
Except on days that it was raining or it was snowing, we could go to school because you couldn't work in the fields in the inclement weather. But and then from late November to 1st of April, we were able to go to school full time.
Okay.
So, the school operated on a regular 9-month basis, and we were expected to redeem the time and catch up.
Okay.
I still finished high school valedictorian.
Wow, congratulations.
in spite of having only been going to school about 5-6 months a year.
So how was the school? Was it a first grade through 8th grade or first grade through 12th grade?
First grade through 12th grade.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And the black people, it was a public school, but the black people built it.
Oh, okay.
Because they wanted...
Was it part of a Rosenwald? It wasn't part of a Rosenwald school?
I don't remember.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So all black teachers, all black students.
And that's correct. That's correct.
About how many students? It was like a neighborhood school.
Jonesboro at that time was a small town. It was only about 15,000-20,000 people.
Okay.
So it had a small black population, probably less than 10 to 15% black. So my high school class, for example. There were only 6 graduated in my class.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And there were from K through from first through the 12th grade at that school. There were not more than 250 students.
Okay, that's what I was thinking. So after you graduated from high school, what did you do?
I went directly to college.
At home? You stayed at
I went to University of Arkansas, Pine Bluff.
Okay.
It was called AM&N College then. It was the segregated, state-supported college.
Mm-hmm.
That was the only state-supported college for blacks in Arkansas. There were other church-related black colleges like Philander Smith.
Philander?
P-H-I-L-A-N-D-E-R? Yeah, Philander Smith, which is a Methodist school. And Arkansas Baptist College. And then there were business colleges for blacks and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But the lines were drawn very clearly that blacks did not attend the state universities and the colleges that were reserved for white people.
Okay.
So the education was.
Was this considered a historically black college at that time?
It was.
Okay.
Yeah. It was established in the late 60s, early 70s. It was one of what they called the land grant colleges.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. So what were your impressions of the school as far as the curriculum, segregation, teachers, diversity? There was probably no diversity, race relations or things of that sort.
It was the society was strictly segregated.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And you're talking about an era when the law and those who were the involved in government and any agency that controlled the lives of people, there was a understanding that blacks were inferior and they had no rights that white folks had to respect.
Mm.
And so it was a very ungodly situation. The segregation resulted in the warping of personalities and the building of and the maintaining of fear that continues to affect people. I'm still affected by some of that today after all these years because it was an atmosphere of intimidation and fear.
Fear and from the white? Whites?
From white police officers.
Okay.
Or sheriffs. Or judges. Or young hoodlums.
Okay.
They could just at random.
So people in authority and without any authority other than being the color of their skin.
And you had no recourse.
Mm. What, I'm going to go back to something. What or who allowed you to go to school? What was that education from home? Did your parents instill that? The importance of an education.
Yeah.
Because back in the day, you know, that's not something that a lot of people really fulfilled.
I'd like to tell a story regarding my parents, and I think I should say it more often, that a lot of people historically move from one community or one state to another looking for work,
mm-hmm.
looking for employment opportunities. My parents moved from one place to another looking for a good school to enroll their children.
That's wonderful.
They were married in a little hick town, Rondo, Arkansas.
What's the name of it?
Rondo, R-O-N-D-O, I guess it is.
Okay.
And there was no school there for blacks. So after they had one or two children, they moved to Jonesboro, where there was a K through 12 program for blacks, mm-hmm. a school that had been built by the blacks, but it was tax supported.
Okay.
And then when my siblings and I finished high school at Jonesboro, my parents moved to Pine Bluff to be near the college, so mm-hmm. we could go to college. So that the 12 children that survived, all of us had some college training. But out of that group, there's been an interesting testimony.
Okay.
For example, there are two lawyers, dentists, three pastors, college administrator, educators, and so forth. It's just been amazing.
That is wonderful.
But my dad had a third grade education. But they told us that to get out of this poverty
mm-hmm.
and this unjust society, if you want to live productively and to be able to exercise your rights as a human being, as a child of God, as a citizen, you need two things. One is good religion
mm-hmm.
and good education. And they instill that.
True.
They instill that to us. And
that's
so,
remarkable.
So it was a very... And, of course, we were motivated by some of the negative stuff that we experienced.
Right. Yeah. You know you wanted to do better.
Yes.
And, yeah. Okay.
When I was in high school, they had a countywide contest for high school students to write an essay about the importance of doing research and on the subject of cancer. Cancer was really not as widely... suffered as we're seeing it now.
Right.
Not as wild experience. And I did a paper, and I...
And this is in what year?
This was in the late 40s.
40s, okay.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, I didn't have my picture with the paper. I just sent the paper in, and mm-hmm. they didn't know.
Right.
And so that my paper was selected as the second, to be awarded the second prize, which was, and it was sponsored by the Red Cross.
Mm.
And they notified me that I had been selected. But when they discovered that it from a black person,
mm-hmm.
they canceled the prize. I couldn't get the prize.
Oh, wow.
I don't think it was $50, but
$50. Well, that was a lot then. And plus, it was just the recognition. So they didn't recognize you at all.
That was it.
That was it.
Yeah.
Okay. So that could have one of two effects. Either it would motivate you to, okay, I'm going to somehow spend a great portion of my time
mm-hmm.
Righting the wrongs that have been
yeah.
Laid on me or upon me because of my color and,
yeah.
and making sure I can make a difference. And I think, I know you've done that.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Another thing that I think I must... Give to my parents credit. I've seen the sheriff come out to the house and try to evict us for no reason, whatever. I've seen, I've been in the field with my father when during the summertime when we were without food at home, going to the field to get corn
mm-hmm.
that we'd have something to eat. I was there with him when the landlord came and put a shotgun on him and said, leave that food here. And we planted the food and it harvested.
Right.
It was our food. We sharecroppers.
Right.
We ought to eat from it. And he had to, in the presence of his sons, drop the food and go home empty-handed. These things you don't forget.
Right.
These things.
Mm-hmm. Wow. How was your friends, the friends and teachers? I know back when I was in North Carolina attending school, the teachers were, well, they were everything, and they had so yeah. much respect, and they You saw them in your grocery stores. You saw them at, you know, the churches. The family knew the teachers. And it was just truly a village.
Yeah.
And was it like that?
It was like that. And there was a whole different attitude that prevailed then. I think that the rearing of the children was, in fact, a joint venture between the home, the school, and the church.
Absolutely. Right.
And they all agreed that you ought to obey your parents. They all agreed that you shouldn't lie. They all agreed that you should go to school and you should behave yourself in the classroom and on the playground. That was the agreement. Mm-hmm. And drug addiction and alcoholism was not a real big problem,
right,
because you had the values of honesty and good citizenship reinforced by the major social institutions, the family, the home, the church.
And what I remember, there was never a question. If the teacher would walk over or saw you in the store and told your parents, well, Gloria did this, this, and this, and, you know, I had to spank her, or I had to, mm-hmm. I wasn't like that. I was a real good student.
I'm sure you were.
But, you know, now it was never like the teacher had to explain, or it was always, or that a chance that the family didn't believe the teacher.
No,
it was
just that
one thing.
That was trust.
Yeah, it was trust. And then you knew it was for the betterment of your child, and that person was building character and all those good qualities that you would want your child to possess.
And that had a positive effect upon the child.
Yes, it did.
Now, you know, children are very smart and manipulative.
Yes, they are.
If they know they can play one authority figure against the other, he can go scot-free.
I know.
And they're doing it now.
And it's not good.
No, no.
So when you were at Pine Bluff. College, and what did you major in?
Sociology.
And what did you do with that degree?
And minored in history.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And did you graduate?
I finished Magna's is perfect.
Summa
3.90.
Okay. Right.
Yeah, summa.
Wow.
Yeah. And I had gone to the state university at the wise counsel of my high school principal. I had acknowledged a call to the ministry at 15.
Okay.
And I had planned to go directly from high school to Bible college. But my principal, Mr. Branch, heard those were my plans. And he called me to his office one day and said, I hear you want to go to Bible college. And I said, yes. He said, son, you need to really go to a 4-year liberal arts college first. Get a solid foundation in the liberal arts and philosophy and sociology, and then go to seminary and get the training at the graduate level, and you'll be able to be more effective in your field. And he made it very plain. Nobody had taken that kind of time to explain to me. And it made sense even
sounds
at
like a
17.
Very wise man. Yes.
He was. And so I went to Arkansas. And the decision to study sociology has been very helpful. It is. Later on, I studied social work at the University of Michigan briefly, and I didn't get a degree there. But all of this prepared me for serving the church in the urban communities wherever I've lived.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So when you finished school...
1954.
And then you went to seminary or Bible college?
I went to seminary.
Okay.
The Graduate School of Theology at Oberlin, Ohio.
Okay.
And there I majored in the philosophy of Christianity, or sometimes it's called Christian theology. But it really was a degree in the philosophy of Christianity.
Oh, one moment. Okay.
It's right out of Cleveland, near Cleveland, Ohio.
Okay. Oberlin, near Cleveland.
Mm-hmm. And I selected Oberlin because... in the early 50s, we were getting involved in the civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. King was gearing up to do his thing in Alabama and around the nation. And I felt that church ought to be at the cutting edge, advocating for justice, for change, for peace, mm-hmm. for fairness. And so I applied to several seminaries. Johnson C. Smith, a Presbyterian seminary, I applied to Boston University, it's a Methodist seminary, and Oberlin. Mm-hmm. But I chose Oberlin because Oberlin had a long history in civil rights.
Okay.
It was the first college in America to admit women, and that was a powerful statement.
Yes, it was.
Back in 1833 or so. It was also one of the first major colleges to admit blacks. They had blacks graduating with degrees before the Civil War.
Oh, okay.
John Langston, Langston University is named for, was a graduate of Oberlin in 1845, I think.
Mm.
So that, and in addition to that history, Oberlin was a station in the Underground Railroad.
Okay.
So that history fascinated
right.
me. So I went there, and there I was able to study with some of the great scholars, the philosophers and theologians of that era. Studied with Walter Marshall Horton and Thomas Kepler and mm-hmm. Gordon Mays. These are some giants in theology, and they were recognized mm-hmm. worldwide.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I studied with them.
Okay. How involved were the students in the civil rights activities during that time?
Now it was just beginning to gain momentum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But for example, we were concerned.
Mm-hmm.
There were small protest movements, but we didn't have the kind of involvement that later developed in the early 60s and the 70s.
But there was an awareness among
them. There was an awareness.
Okay.
And little things like housing, dormitory for the seminarians was integrated. We didn't have white and black housing, but that had in some schools that was done.
Okay.
Blacks stayed together and whites together, but I had a white roommate. And
how was that experience?
It was fine.
Okay.
It was fine. The thing that really stood out, my parents never, although we experienced a lot of humiliation and hurt, and we saw a lot of suffering, they taught us never to hate those who are evil and wicked.
My grandmother was the same way. There was never any don't show animosity or don't, you know.
Yeah.
It was always taking the higher road, I would say.
Yeah, vengeance belongs to God,
yeah.
And we don't do very well evening up scores.
Yeah, that's true, even today.
No, that's the rule to live by.
So you were at Oberlin for how many years?
2 years.
2 years. And you graduated with a degree in?
Systematic theology.
And from there, what?
Sticking with the educational piece, mm-hmm. I did one year at the Michigan in social work.
Okay. And this was after Oberlin?
After Oberlin.
And why social work?
After graduating from the School of Theology, I took a job to feed myself. I was still single,
mm-hmm.
but I needed to eat for some reason.
That's an important thing, man.
So I took a job as first as a director of a settlement house in the Chagrin Falls Park area of Cleveland.
Okay.
That's in the ghetto.
Okay.
And it was
what's a settlement house?
It's kind of like neighborhood house used to be. You remember that movement, settlement house, where people who were transferring from the South came.
Oh, so it's like a way station.
They come and it provides services, educational, adult education, and recreational activities and tutoring for children and recreational activities for the families. It was a very exciting project that I worked there for several, oh, I guess about 6 months. Mm-hmm. And that was eye-opener. I'd been acquainted with suffering that related to poverty in the South. But it's a whole different story to see the kind of suffering that people experienced in the concrete jungles of the city. Okay. And so that was a sensitizing experience, and to see the hopelessness and the violence.
I was going to say, what were some of the issues that you encountered in this this place? That was kind of different from the South.
Yeah, the preponderance of drug addiction.
Even in that time.
Yeah, drug addiction. Young people being absolutely rootless and confused, and so therefore resorting to gang and violent activities. Employment was a big problem in that community. Housing was a big problem. If you don't have adequate employment, you can't provide adequate housing for your family.
That's true.
And so and a lot of the kids in the community came to that center because it was there they would have a respite from some of the pressure that they experienced moment to moment in their homes.
Was it a residential, the settlement house?
Or yeah, it was a residential area.
Okay.
People lived all around it.
Okay. But people would come in. It was like the Boys and Girls Club of today. They would stop by.
That's right.
Okay.
And it was sponsored.
Probably one of the only positive influences in their life at that time frame.
That's correct.
Okay.
Sponsored by some people, some white people of goodwill. They put the money up for it. That's what some of the settlement houses had, that kind of background, that some of the people who had accumulated wealth, they were going to, I'm going to support this kind of a project, and they did.
Okay.
So, but that was a good experience, Chagrin Falls Park. Okay. And from there, I went to Toledo, accepted the job as the Protestant chaplain at the Toledo State Hospital.
Okay. As a Protestant chaplain.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a hospital, a regular hospital?
It's a mental hospital.
Mental hospital.
3,000 patients.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, as a Protestant chaplain, I had a chance to, I lived on the ground. It was like a huge college campus.
Okay.
But it wasn't.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
Oh. And how long were you there?
I was there for about 1 year.
What was a highlight and a low light? What was one thing that just really, and you could.
Yeah, it was a challenge. I'm a young theologian, yeah, very young, and here my congregation were all mentally ill.
Right.
And that's a challenge.
Right.
And at that time there was a movement to make the clergy a part of the therapeutic team at the hospital. So I had the privilege of sitting in on staff meetings as
that's a good thing, right? Wouldn't you think?
Very, very good thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And as a part of the interview, I would interview the patients when they came in, would also conduct worship and funerals and so forth. One of the things, and always I remember, there would be people at that time committed to the hospital, and the families would forget about them.
I was going to ask you about that.
It was kind of sad to go to a funeral and nobody showed up because they didn't own the person any longer, or whatever they were.
There was such a stigma back in the day about mental illness.
That's right.
Yeah,
they were still doing the lobotomies. Surgeries, removing portions of the brain, and I was, as a member of the therapeutic team, I was invited to observe that surgery, but I never went in to watch it.
Mm-hmm.
But I did observe the electroshock treatment, and that was a horrendous thing.
Just treated them like experimenting with animals, Do you think they were really trying to find a cure or to help them, or they just let's just try this and see what happens. And
I think that's probably the motive. However, you can't rule out altogether that some people who just have no regard for the sacredness of life, there are some people who have no regard for the sacredness of life, and that's why there's need to have persons who have ethics and spiritual consciousness.
That is true. Involved. Now, were they all African Americans?
No, it was mixed. It was well mixed. Mm-hmm.
And you were there in, this was like, are we in the 50s?
That's in the 50s, that's right. 50s.
And for a year?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And from there, where did you, you've had a varied, a very diverse.
Yeah, it was kind of.
Life.
Yes.
But
yes.
Each thing has prepared you, and this is God working, prepared mm-hmm. you for what's to come next.
That's
and
right.
Even now, I'm sure you can reach back and pull.
I don't know what's going to be next. But it's been good. It's been good. After that, of course, I continued to in the ministry. I volunteered to do ministry at a Church of God in Christ in Toledo. Pastor was about 90 years old, and he needed a younger man to help him. Okay. And I volunteered as his associate pastor, and I was there for about 2 years.
Okay.
And I was also.
So this was like a pastor in training?
That's right. That's right. Free.
Yeah.
And at the same to feed my. By this time I was married.
Okay.
So I had to take a job as well as a probation officer with the juvenile probation department in Toledo.
Okay.
Worked there for 2 years.
And how long were you in Toledo at this? Working as a
with the probation
pastor in
a total of about 3 years in Toledo.
And from there,
that's when I came to California.
So how did you people ask me, well, you're from North Carolina, how did you get to California? So how did you get to California?
You want me to tell you how I got here?
I do. Military?
No, I'm not. I don't mean to be real spiritual, but I must tell you what happened. I had the.
Oh, be spiritual. I'm okay with that.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yes, sir, absolutely.
Okay. Well, what happened, I had really become fascinated by the possibility of working in a historically black college.
Okay.
My philosophy professor in undergrad at Arkansas, we formed a good bond, and he had scheduled a course for incoming freshmen during the summer, but he could not fulfill it because of something that happened. And he got approval from the administration that his student, George McKinney, would teach his class in philosophy to the incoming freshmen at the summer after my graduation. So I stayed on to teach, and I loved it.
Okay.
I think that's probably my ego was.
Ego can be good.
Yeah. So I really liked teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that after the Oberlin experience, I could probably serve well as a chaplain and a teacher in the religion department at some of the historically black schools. Sent out a number of resumes. And nobody hired me.
All this experience in education.
Yeah, yeah. Then I thought, well, maybe I'll just go to Africa as a missionary
mm-hmm.
and do some work with the orphans and the people of Liberia or Congo or someplace. No mission board would hire me. So here I was about ready to graduate from school with no real concrete offers.
Mm-hmm.
But one day in my prayer time, alone in my dormitory room, I had this sudden knowing, an awareness, a consciousness that your work will be in California. Period. No handwriting on the wall.
Now, this was when you were in Arkansas or when you were
in Oberlin?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I understood that it was.
You didn't know anyone? No contact with anyone in California?
I had never been to California. didn't have no intentions of coming here. But I said that experience was so clear that I never doubted that it was leading of the Lord. In our tradition, we believe that people can be led of God in their major decisions. And that's what I've been conditioned to believe. And I sense that voice that your work will be in California. And so from that moment on, I began thinking in terms of transitioning. It took from 56 to 59 to follow it all out, to implement it. Mm-hmm. But when time came...
That wasn't long. You weren't 40 years.
No, that makes a difference. 33 years, that's not too bad.
Not too bad at all.
So that's how we got it. And what I believe was a leading of God to come. And it has been, I think, a very exciting journey.
So you... And you just... Okay, this is where God is leading me.
Yeah.
And you just followed that voice.
Yes. And I knew that I had some experience as a counselor with probation, so I wrote to the probation department here and said I'd like to come and work for you. And they said, they still looked at my resume and said, come on. Got here on a Saturday and went to work Monday.
Oh, that is just a wonderful testimony. That is great. And it was San Diego?
Yes.
So how long did you work for the probation, and then how was...
I worked for them from 59 until 64.
So somewhere in here you had some children.
Oh, yeah. I got married in 1957.
Okay.
And my first, our first child was born in 58, okay. December of 58. And then for the next 10 years, we had a total of 5 children.
Mm-hmm. Every other year?
Yeah. But we discovered what was causing it.
Okay. And from probation, what was San Diego like in the 50s? When you get in 59, so it was actually 59, 60, early 60s. And I know that period, time frame, was at the height of the civil rights movement in the South. But what were race relations like in San Diego at that time, and as a probation officer? So you were someone with a relatively high-profile job, I would think.
Yeah, the probation department sort of...
Was it on the social work or police department?
No, it's a separate...
It's a separate entity.
Criminal justice. But the probation had broken ice and hired a black woman as a probation officer just a few years before I got here. Her name was Ruth Green. She was still working. So the first...
What was her name?
Ruth Green.
Okay.
She was the first black probation officer in San Diego County.
And a female. Wow.
And a female. The sheriff's department had never hired a black, maybe other than, you know, janitors and that, but nobody as a uniformed officer. And Leon Williams was hired by the sheriff's department as the first professional black.
I remember.
And I was here when that happened.
Okay.
There were no black judges. The black physicians, you could count them on one hand. Very few black lawyers. Very few black bankers, probably none.
And we're talking about 59 through...
59 through 63, 64. No black principals of any of the schools. The schools in the black neighborhoods were all led by white or Hispanic administrators. No black principals. So it was... Then as now, it's a beautiful city. The weather is unmatched. The scenery is breathtaking.
Yes, it is.
But socially and educationally and culturally, there were some real serious challenges. So what about race relations?
Mm-hmm.
As long as black people stayed in that place,
okay,
they were okay. It was...
unseen and unheard, sort of?
Yeah. Yeah. It was real. Shortly after I arrived here, although I had a job at probation, there was an opening for a chaplain with one of the other county agencies, mm-hmm. Correctional agencies, and they advertised for a person who had a bachelor's degree and some experience in counseling. I applied for that job and was told that I was the best candidate and should be hired for it. But when I made my appearance to claim my job,
mm-hmm. again,
they said, no, we made a mistake, and we have to reopen this and rewrite the job description.
And they told you like that?
Yeah.
Wow.
And so racism was very, and housing was, when I got here, we wanted to know where I could be, a wife and 9-month-old son. Where do we find a place to live? They said, well, coloreds live off of 47th and Market in the off of Guymon, the Glencliff Apartments. That's where the coloreds live.
That's what they told you.
That's what it costs.
So in other words, that's where you want to be if you're going to stay here.
So I went out and found me a little apartment. And of course, there was a urban league director named Percy Steele. He was very helpful.
Okay.
And he knew the ropes, and he gave us what the options were. There were some areas that blacks could not live, and for a while there were some areas where Jews couldn't live because of restrictive, mm-hmm. Restrictive covenants.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that was all legal.
That's right.
So
the police department primarily, well, there was a few blacks, and mm-hmm. that Johnny Williams, who we attended his funeral the other day, was the first black detective. And we were friends. I was working at probation at the same time as he was with the police department. Mm. But in spite of the segregation and the racism, Gloria, there were those people of goodwill, black, white, brown, mm-hmm. Chinese, Filipino, whatever, who knew that this old system of segregation and the oppression of any group on the basis of race, that was unacceptable, that was anti-American, that it was wrong. And there have always been people who stood up and said, it has to be better than this, mm-hmm. and we must change it. And so in spite of all the stuff that was going on, there were voices crying out for justice and right. for righteousness and for fair play.
So when did that organized attempt to level the playing field take place? And in what group, and kind of was at the forefront of saying, oh, you know, this is not right, and we can no longer sit back and allow this to happen, but we have to make our voices heard to make this better for all people.
Yeah. I think there were many groups, but it really, the role of the church has been key.
Okay.
And we've had some powerful pastors and leaders in the local churches that have been at the cutting edge of social change.
Okay.
Also, I think the Urban League and the Neighborhood House Association and certain social groups, I can't think of their names now, but there have been social groups that included women and men.
Mm-hmm.
And those blacks who came here who had been a part of fraternities or sororities and the black, historically black colleges, they
right.
continued to kind of band together and use their influence. The links.
Mm-hmm.
And groups like that have been involved in the fight. When the civil rights movement really came to San Diego under King, there was the community was ripe for that involvement. I remember attending King's first speech here in San Diego on June 15th, 1960.
Wow.
June 15th, 1960.
Dr. Martin Luther King was here speaking.
Yeah, at Calvary Baptist Church. That church probably seats 1,500, 2,000.
Right.
It was packed.
Mm.
And King was dynamic.
Why was he asked to come here? Or did he come as a, just to...
The ministers invited him.
Okay.
Because the ministers
so
felt
really
that we wanted...
an organized group.
That's right. We wanted to be a part of the movement.
Okay.
And so we organized here to have marches and to boycott. We walked the boycott line at the Bank of America because they wouldn't hire black folk except as janitors. No tellers, no vice presidents, no secretaries.
Was that the only bank that would not hire, or
it was the biggest one.
Okay.
It was the big boy.
That is right. Mm. Yeah.
The Bank of America and Woolworths was the one of the store that would not hire blacks, and there was a a lunch counter at Woolworths, and there were other institutions that we boycotted, picketed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I need to find that restroom now.
Okay. You want me to record this?
Yeah, please.
Okay.
The ministers were at the cutting edge of the movement to really press forward in the fight for justice and equity and the helping people to realize that the promises that were made in the Constitution and in our history should not be abandoned.
Okay.
And the city, although there were real serious pockets of segregation and negativism, but there were still persons in the city government or in leadership in the city who wanted a better life for all of the citizens. And I think it was a significant thing when the city organized the group for racial reconciliation and integration and hired Carol Wayman to come to direct it.
Okay.
And Carol Wayman was a spark plug in the movement. He came here with fire and with training.
I spoke to him about some of the things. Yeah.
And he used to conduct
They actually sent for him to do this?
I think they did. I don't think he was here before. And Wayman, and of course, you had people like Harold Brown with the Congress of Racial Equality, mm-hmm. George Walker Smith, the Presbyterian Church, E. Major Shavers of the Congregational Church.
Who is this?
E. Major Shavers.
Is he living?
No, he's deceased.
Okay.
J. Blake of the Church of God in Christ.
Is he related to Blake at West Los Angeles?
It's his father.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. He is the pastor I came and trained under here for the first 2 years when I got to California. S. M. Lockridge, pastor of Calvary Baptist.
Right.
Dr. Charles Hampton at Bethel Baptist. Dr. Washington also a Baptist pastor, and Janie Johnson, a Baptist at Trinity Baptist, I believe. It was quite a lineup of committed clergymen, most of them from the South, who had fire in their bones for change.
Was it a name for the group? Or it was just meeting?
The ministers were the Southeast Ministerial Association. But the group that Carol Wayman led was, I'm trying to think of the name of it, it was,
I know I have it in my notes. I can't.
It has to do with some kind of Congress right for right. racial, yeah. But it was a timely organization. It came into being at the right time and had the right leader. It was good. Carol brought passion, intelligence, excellent training.
Okay.
And he was able to talk the language of both the in and the out and the down and the out.
Oh, that's wonderful. Mm-hmm. To be able to do that is a really good thing. And what was one of the major things that, or what was one thing that happened as a result of this group that made the living conditions better for people of color?
Mm-hmm.
I
think the pressure that from the boycotts and the picketing of those institutions where they refused to hire or to give to or even to serve black people, whatever. I think they eventually changed because of, we became a part of a nationwide movement.
And then anytime you dip into someone's pocket financially or lack of that, then that causes them to kind of look at things a little differently.
Absolutely. And, of course, there are some political things made that took place regarding the housing situation. We had a law passed that would no longer allow restrictive covenants to be effective. You couldn't say that a person would be denied purchasing a house because of their ethnic affiliation or religion.
Okay. So there were legal barriers that
were removed.
Removed,
yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
How about the, what was your perception of the police or law enforcement at this time? And did you have any encounters with them?
As a probation officer, I had frequent encounters with them regarding cases.
Okay. But as community, with them being in the community, what was the relationship like among African American blacks and police officers or law enforcement?
On the positive side, the police department early on organized a community relations department, and the first sergeant in charge of that was who later became the police chief and the sheriff here. I guess my age. Yeah, I'll think of his name in a minute. But he just retired from
Colander. Bill Colander.
Bill Colander.
Okay.
Bill Colander, and Bill brought a perspective from his religion and his background.
Some really nice things about him.
Bill Colander believed in justice. He believed in fair play, and he was a force for good in the department. Of course, that being said, there were those who were frontline officers who had come here from Mississippi, Georgia, Arkansas, Texas, and they were able to pass the exam, and they were given a badge and a gun, and they often reflected their prejudices in their their administration of justice.
Okay.
So there have been a number of situations where blacks have been murdered by police, but always it was claimed to be justifiable homicide.
Yeah.
We know that there have been some cases that have been related that have been that I've been involved in because family members were at the church where I serve.
Mm-hmm.
And there were instances where there was absolute disregard for the sacredness of life or the reality of the law.
Oh, wow.
But